he looked like a completely different person. He was standing in court with a shaved head. In the pictures, that was hidden by that fur headdress. You know, the one made from coyote tails, with two large horns sticking out either side. The tattoos on his chest were covered up, and instead of the red, white, and blue American flag, on his face was an expression filled with remorse. Jacob Chansley earned the nickname the QAnon Shaman when images of him storming the US Capitol hit the front pages. He was a supporter of the QAnon conspiracy and believed the election had been rigged. But as he stood in court, just 10 months after January 6th, he really looked like a changed man. A judge called his apology the most remarkable he'd heard in 34 years.
He just looked like every other American man. I mean, he put on a suit, you know, he trimmed his beard, fixed his hair, he had glasses. I mean, he just...
That's Lauren O'Burr. She's a journalist from Washington, D.C., and one of the jurors of a January 6th trial.
I mean, he just looked like a regular dude.
But that's not Jacob Chansley she's talking about. It's Taylor John Attakis. But it just as easily could have been Jacob, or Daniel Goodwin, or Derek Evans, or Joseph Biggs, or Dominic Pozzola, or James Little, or another of the thousands of people who have been tried for their crimes on January 6th, as part of the FBI's largest criminal investigation in United States history. They all pleaded guilty, apologised in court, and served time in prison. The plan to heal America seemed to be working. But this was not the end of Jacob or Taylor or any of the others fall down the rabbit hole. In fact, it was only the beginning. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Whole Truth. The story starts in Washington, D.C.
So Washington, D.C. is an interesting place because it is neither a city nor a state in the United States. It is a federal enclave. It is where all of the business of government happens. But there are also nearly 800,000 people living there. Like, most people who live here have come here to do good in whatever that means to them. So there are a lot of journalists, and there are a lot of politicians, and there are a lot of people who work for NGOs. And so it's a city of do-gooders and dweebs. There was not a feeling that anything was going to happen on January 6th, because historically that is a nothing day. It's just a very perfunctory duty happens. It is ceremonial at best. On January 6th, I'm driving to help a friend move house in Atlanta, Georgia, which is, you know, like an 8-hour drive away. And I'm cruising down the highway, and all of a sudden I'm getting text messages from people. Are you okay? Is everything okay in D.C.? What's going on in D.C.? And then I hear from my partner that her kids had been sent home from school because the Trump rally became a riot.
Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and for the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you. I will tell you.
And the city was basically, the city's locked down at this point. The minute that I landed in Atlanta, I flipped on the news. I'm watching this, like, utter chaos and destruction happen in my city. And I have friends who work at the Capitol complex. And I have, you know, friends who work around there and friends who live near there. And
I'm watching this, like, utter chaos and destruction happen
in my city.
It was hard.
And
it's hard on the day to get an accurate picture of what was going on.
It was so chaotic.
The city is locked down.
And I was became a riot. I was terrified, you know.
After January 6th, the FBI began the largest criminal investigation in United States history. Approximately 2,000 people have been charged, convicted, and prosecuted for crimes committed on that day.
It all happened in Washington, D.C., so all of the cases were here in Washington, D.C. And it's taken a really long time to work through the court system, and it's backed up our federal court here in Washington, D.C. And so all these cases are being adjudicated. Most of them, people are pleading guilty. There's no trial. But for a small handful of defendants, about 200, 250 people, they chose to go to court and you know, like throw caution to the wind and leave their fate in the hands of 12 random people from Washington, D.C. I, as a journalist, would never expect to get on a jury because we get dismissed immediately. I also have my father was a former prosecutor, so that also disqualifies me in most instances. So I've never served on a jury. In November of 2023, I got called for jury duty for a January 6th case. I just assumed in this instance that I would get booted out of the jury pool and I'd go back home and, you know, carry on with my life. And that is not what happened, because this particular defendant, he chose to defend himself, which you can do in the U.S. without a lawyer. And also, he chose not to offer any challenges to jury selection. And so out of nowhere, I'm all of a sudden on a January 6th jury. His name was Taylor John Attakis. He was a septic system installer, a father of five children, formerly a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints, aka Mormon. He was like an every guy. And what we came to learn is that during the Trump administration, he got increasingly sort of radicalized and interested in Donald Trump and, you know, Make America Great Again ideology. And he came to Washington because he truly believed that the election, the 2020 presidential election, had been stolen. And he was going to stop the steal and stop the tyrants from taking over the country. And he was preserving liberty and, you know, defending democracy, right? This is what he truly felt.
Almost everybody tried for January 6th has been found guilty because there is so much video evidence.
He took tons of videos of himself before, during, and after the insurrection.
So we're walking over to the Capitol right now and I don't know, maybe we'll break down the doors.
He carried a megaphone with him and he was shouting into the megaphone all these kinds of things about the vice president is a pedophile and this XYZ about China. And he's screaming and no one's really listening to him because he's like, who's this guy? Why is he screaming all this weird stuff into a megaphone? But you know, as you watch the video, you're sitting there watching him watch himself.
In the video, Taylor shouts into his megaphone, trying to rally a bunch of people to push against the fencing that surrounds the Capitol building. The rioters line up against the barricade. Taylor shouts, one, two, three, and they push up against it. The police push back. The group falls. Taylor collapses to the ground. He gets pepper sprayed in the face.
And that's it. It's over. It took less than 1 minute. The actions that he took over those, you know, less than 60 seconds cost him a felony conviction and 7 years in prison. It's interesting to think about remorse, you know, because I think he was sorry that he took it so far. I think what happened is the vast majority of people who got caught up in January 6th, for them, it was the worst day of their lives. And it was the worst day for, you know, the 30, 40 seconds that they participated in something, or, you know, or maybe they were there for a half an hour and they got caught up in the mob mentality. But most of these people had not had a criminal record, and this defendant didn't have a criminal record. I mean, he was a Boy Scout, for God's sakes. He was a basketball coach.
When it was time for the jury to deliberate, she had a moral dilemma.
I personally had a lot of conflicting feelings about, for one, just being on a jury and rendering judgment against another person is a very heavy task. And especially when you know that behind that guilty verdict is a prison sentence. I just kept thinking, here was a guy who was throwing his entire life away. For what? For a person, for an idea. You know, he's abandoning his family, his children. I mean, my conflict was, here was a man who, like, he was just like a bumbling weirdo who was not dangerous. And he was being charged with, you know, 3 felonies and 4 misdemeanors, and that is no joke. And in a normal situation, as a first-time offender, he would maybe get probation and community service or something like that. Like, first-time offenders in those instances, typically, you know, the court is more generous. In this instance, they didn't care. They wanted maximal pain and punishment so that this would never happen again. I understand that. As like a citizen, I understand why they wanted to do that. I understand that people were not being persecuted for their beliefs, but for their actions. But also, is there something else that could have been done? Is there a different form of punishment that would have achieved the same goal, which is like, we never want this to happen again?
They came to a decision. Taylor Jonatakis was pronounced guilty. Immediately after he was pronounced guilty, Taylor was sent to the Washington, D.C. jail.
The D.C. jail has a mix of people. People who have committed, you know, local crimes, murder here in D.C., you know, all kinds of felonies. And then you have all these people who just came through January 6th who committed a federal crime. And they are largely white.
The population of the D.C. jail is about 90% black. But suddenly they were importing a bunch of guys whose collective reputation was white supremacist.
And so the U.S. Marshals, who, you know, run this facility, said it would be in everyone's best interest if we split the January 6ers and put them in a protective unit. And by protective unit, that's more just protecting them, like the other prisoners from them or whatever. So they ended up being housed in a different part of the prison or the jail by themselves.
This meant there would be 20 to 40 guys all in there for similar offences at one time, either awaiting trial because they were violent or awaiting sentencing because they had already been convicted. It became known as the Patriot Pod. Lauren compares it to
maybe like a fraternity house under lock and key, right?
The guys in the Patriot Pod cut each other's hair, did weightlifting competitions, even put on plays together.
So they put all of these guys together, and I guess what happens when you put a bunch of people who have committed the same crimes together is, you know, they all start talking to each other and they all start, their ideas bounce up against each other and they're emboldened and they're getting feedback that is like, you know, you're good. No, you're good. No, like, this was good. We did the right thing. And it becomes this, like, club. So here you have all of these, you know, all these guys who are just becoming more and more emboldened in their stances, in their rightness, believing that what they did was right and honorable on January 6th.